coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
We are back with our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost, according to Series A of the three-year series lectionary. And they are Isaiah 59 verses 6 to 9, Psalm 27 verses 1 to 9, Philippians 1 verses 12 to 14, and 19 to 30. And the gospel lesson is from Matthew 20 verses 1 to 16. We begin, as always, with David Weber.
Gilbert Ryle was the editor of the journal Mind, and he was asked once if it was true that he accepted or rejected an article on the basis of reading just the first paragraph. "That used to be true at one time," Ryle replied. "I had a lot more time in those days." And I think the quip casts light on our task in preaching, that I know it's difficult, but to gain the listener's interest in the text right from the beginning, from the first sentence, and certainly to gain that interest in the first paragraph. And I know that sermons that I listen to oftentimes don't even address the text. Usually there's some kind of a sermon analogy, they call it, or a too cute story. And so I'm just thinking that this text today makes it easy to enter right into it because of the crazy question that the vineyard owner asks, "Do you begrudge my generosity?" And the what's curious about this is that that I'm not used to having generosity generate resentment and envy, which is at the center of this parable. So more and more, I'd like to give some thought of what in the text is the thing that draws our attention, and especially in texts that are more difficult. So the question, "Do you begrudge my generosity?" is just such a good place to start. And the unexpressed answer to the question is, well, who wouldn't envy the late hired freeloaders who benefited from the scandalously unequal pay-to-work ratio? Who wouldn't think something was desperately wrong when doing more work actually created greater envy? Karl Marx would have said that the alienation of the worker from his labor ignited a class warfare with the late hires and the vineyard owner. Something feels desperately wrong with the way that the people first hired were treated. And what's hard to understand is the owner's claim that he was acting in generosity. And even harder to see that generosity could generate such envy. Now, I think that the parable gives a master class in storytelling. Because, at least for me, it helped me viscerally feel the envy that the first workers, the first hired, had felt. And I think that the weight of the parable wants us to take their side and understand their resentment. So by having us place ourselves in their position. So in feeling that envy, we begin to understand, I think, the difficulty of what it means to live by grace. That the owner says this is his generosity. This is another word for grace. And the way, grace is difficult because it's God who is distributing the goodness. And if this parable is any indication, God distributes his goodness in uneven and seemingly capricious ways. So a lot of times we're used to hearing people talk about how easy it is to live by grace. You don't do anything. And that's precisely the problem with this. All of this comes from God and the distribution of his generosity. So envy names the disciples' temptation once they experience Christ's righteousness. See, this is aimed at the disciples, and Christ is alerting them to the temptation of envy. And the envy is going to be generated by Christ's righteousness, because this righteousness, when it does its work, the last become first and the first become last. Now, remember, these are the disciples that were so interested in greatness and interested in their place in the hierarchy of greatness. This turns any hierarchy of greatness on its head. So the parable indicates that envy is at the threshold of all who believe in God's grace, that this grace is given without regard to fairness, and it is a righteousness that shifts our whole understanding of what should come first and what comes last. So I repeat this often, is I think Chesterton's understanding of Christ's righteousness is really helpful. In his view, the world fell, and when the world fell, it fell on its head, which means that we see everything upside down. So when Christ makes the world righteous, he turns things upright. And so now the first become last and the last become first. And that, and this parable alerts us that that is not going to be an arrangement which is going to be easy to understand. And the difficulty is to say, how would those who were first hired, how could they not resent this turning of things on its head? But how could they, along with the master and with those hired at the end of the day, how could they accept their position with gratitude and rejoicing rather than with envy? I think that's one of, again, the tacit or unexpressed questions. Right, this is a lengthy introduction then to get to that point. So we can get to the point by asking why Jesus would direct a parable about envy at his followers. And I think it's because the disciples were going to be first hour hires, and that they would find out at great personal cost, God would establish his vineyard, the church on earth. They would be the leading edge of this establishment, and that would be come at a high personal cost. And if their sacrifice was to be the cause of rejoicing rather than resentment, they would need to bear their cross with the same freedom and joy as Christ bore his cross. And the distraction and the temptation would be rather to resent their position as first hires and to be envious of those who seem to be freeloaders, when in fact grace does give goodness for free. And again, I'll repeat what I've said before. The philosopher Nietzsche gave the church a great gift in arguing that that this whole arrangement of grace must always create envy and resentment. It would be humanly impossible to imagine the first workers rejoicing in bearing the cross. And the parable is basically saying, Jesus asserting that, yes, with humanity it is impossible, but for God all things are possible, including that the disciples would be first hires that would rejoice in rather than resent it. So how do we escape envy and rather rejoice in the distribution of God's grace? And thankfully, we've just dealt with the passage where Jesus alerts us that his forgiveness is unlimited. This is one of those things that is not going to come easy, but yet it's worth doing even if it's done badly. So the parable first expresses the perspective of the early hires' envy, and I think it gets us on their side. And in contrast, There is the perspective of late hires. So the way that parables work is that they give us alternative to envies, and they characterize those alternatives, and the characterization is the perspective of the land, the vineyard owner, and the perspective of the late hires, both of whom saw this generosity as the cause of rejoicing and not of resentment. So how is it that those early hires can take the perspective of the late hires or the vineyard owner? How could they participate in that rejoicing? So, and the question is delivered to the disciples. If they are the early hires, how could they experience God's generosity towards those who would benefit from their sacrifice with rejoicing rather than resentment? How could they take up the cross with the same joy that the book of Hebrews said characterizes Jesus' sacrifice? It wasn't imposed upon him. It wasn't forced. It was a suffering that was expressive of his joy. And the easy answer, but the difficult thing of making it stick, would be they would have to see themselves as connected to those who follow them in a bond of love. And they would have to see that connection, that they would receive freely and rejoice that others would benefit from their sacrifice. They could not any longer see themselves as slighted individuals who got a raw deal. They would have to see themselves as connected to the vineyard owner and connected to those who follow. And in that connection, they would rejoice in God's generosity, that they themselves would see themselves as expressions of God's generosity. They would be God's gift to others, just as Christ was a gift to humanity. And they would understand themselves in a very different way. We oftentimes, a person who is filled with pride says that they are God's gift to humanity. That, in fact, is what Jesus is preparing his disciples to become, to rejoice in the fact and not resent the fact that God is generous. And one of the ways that God expresses his generosity is by giving his people who have experienced his generosity, giving them to others in the same way that he has given his son to die for us. And if Christ's cross is a source of rejoicing, then when God gives us to others, that too can be the source of rejoicing rather than resentment.
What about for those people, though, who can't, or for whom the envy never goes away? Is there a way, instead of just doing away with the envy, of transforming it or sanctifying it?
Okay, first of all, I really like this because I think envy does not easily go away. For Christ to think that it's possible for us to be early hires and not resent that position, I think is almost miraculous. And anytime we're bordering on the miraculous, we're going to have infinite forgiveness. So at any rate, we've got this brilliant parable with God drawing us up into his kind of thinking rather than we being drawn down into the envy and resentment. The psalm furthers the claim in saying, the psalmist says, "One thing I asked of the Lord." One thing. I mean, this is the one thing needful in Scripture. What would be the one thing if you're off on a desert island or you're off on a terrible situation? What would you ask of the Lord? And he says, this is the one thing I seek, just to be, you know, the parallelism reinforces, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Now, that's crazy, especially because we live at a time where people think it's utter freedom that they don't have to go to the house of the Lord any longer. So the contrast between, you know, the present secularism and here's what I would need in order to live in life. It's what takes place in the house of the Lord. And later he tells us, he says, in the house of the Lord, he is able to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, that he can tolerate any ugliness that he's dealing with in the world, so long as there is the house of the Lord in which the beauty of the Lord is fully displayed. Now, God's presence is this beauty. And because God is present, we say, in the house of the Lord, it offers the different perspective on the world that we said that the parable offers in pointing to people who rejoice at the generosity of the vineyard owner. So this dwelling in the house of the Lord gave a shelter from the ugliness of this world, from the resentment of this world, in order to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And that beauty in the parable is called generosity. And to not only gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, but to be a participant in that beauty. So I think on the level of theory, if you were to ask me, how do you transcend resentment? The alternative, according to the psalm, is beauty. And it's seeing the beauty in the vineyard owner's generosity. And this is the world that the psalmist recognizes is saturated with fear of foes and the adversity of adversaries. This isn't an idealistic psalm. He recognizes what this world can be. And dwelling in the presence of God's beauty is an alternative. It's what we call salvation. And it gives the psalmist the confidence to live in this world and dispels fear. So we might say that the beauty of the Lord, as in the gospel, is to be joyful in God's crazy generosity, which, you know, is unpredictable. It turns the last to the first, and that becomes the alternative to the envy. So now that's quite a promise. The psalmist isn't lying, we presume. He really does get lifted up. His heart is actually lifted up by this vision of God's beauty, rather than dragged down into envy and into resentment. The psalmist really does expect his life to be transformed. And that transformation, in terms of the text today, is a transformation from envy to enjoyment, from resenting God's graciousness to enjoying the craziness of it. And now, again, as people are evacuating churches and calling it the new freedom, I wonder what they do. They still have to live in a world of resentment and envy. And if there's no refuge from that, I just think that we're entering in a phase of deeper sadness and despair.
There is something to having that place to go to as a refuge in the middle of the envy and the resentment, of not just holding yourself up in your room or in your house, but of actually having essentially that escape, right?
Right.
That escape that is the house of the Lord for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I've just been one of the side things I was thinking about once I did get to the psalm and recognize that the answer, as superficial and quick as it seems, is really being in God's presence, which we claim happens in word and sacrament worship. Right? It's easy to claim. And what makes it more difficult is that if we were to ask our congregants, you know, do they experience Sunday worship as this refuge, this place of gazing upon a beauty that you can never see in the world? Now, going on to Isaiah, again, I don't know how often how much the explicit text gets into the sermon, but these texts add a depth to my own personal reflection and meditation on the meaning of the gospel. And this text I'm probably not going to mention, but there's this beautiful assertion that where God says to Isaiah, "Your ways are not my ways." And God is not dismissing or diminishing Isaiah's ways. He's rather inviting Isaiah and us to allow God to elevate and expand his earthbound perspective, to learn to see beyond the ever-diminishing ways of this world. So most importantly, God invites us to think and to think differently, not to think like earthbound people, but to have our, to be, to think like people who are eternity bound, which is to say unbounded by time and space. Again, that unbounded was explicit in the gospel and in a generosity, which is just so insane that it flips the whole hierarchy of greatness. So the elevation and expansion of our thinking begins by seeking God, who is near to us. So that's the same theme as the psalm, going to the house of worship to seek God. Because God is not far off, he's rather near, and he promises to draw us nearer to his ways. And drawing nearer means, for Isaiah, giving up wickedness. And the wickedness is very clear. It's comparing ourselves to others and competing for limited and scarce goods. That is the world of the diminishing world. But we are being drawn into God's ways, which are eternal, where his mercy has no limit and his generosity flips the whole world script on its head. So the single word that we believe as Lutherans captures that God's way is grace. That seems, we say that all things go through, all things important in life go through that word grace, which indicates that to see things as God sees things is to see everything as a gift, that everything is an expression of generosity. And even if we suffer some envy and resentment from that generosity, eventually we will come around to rejoice in the gift as God rejoices in his gift. So that generosity that generated so much envy in Jesus' parable also cured the envy. So it was the cause and the cure for an envy once we begin to desire to not be earthbound and envious, but to be rather take God's perspective in being generous. And in seeing our own lives in that generosity, our own lives as being a gift to others. So by thinking like God thinks, this is what Isaiah is offered. The resentment of grace in allowing freeloaders to benefit from our labor becomes rejoicing, because Isaiah is being told he is a co-participant in God's work. Looking forward, Isaiah would recognize that he would be a co-participant in God's great gift to humanity of the suffering, death, and resurrection. So the cross, as we said earlier, changes everything. The cross speaks to Nietzsche's point that human beings cannot get past their envy or resentment. And the cross is this thing that's staked in the middle of history, that, yes, God's truths are not our truths, and God's ways are not our ways, but God's way is infinitely better and eternally promising. And now we finish with, sadly, again, a text that probably won't make it into the sermon, but it is a text that is that actually expands on the sermon. And the key to this text is Paul's claim that to live is Christ, to die is gain. Now, the context for this is that Paul is trying to make sense to the church why his suffering is unequal. He is bearing a greater share of suffering, particularly by his recent imprisonment. And he says to the church, he wants the church to know, I want you to know that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard. So in other words, Paul is rejoicing in his imprisonment because he recognized that he was God's gift to the imperial guard, and the only way the imperial guard would ever come to see the beauty and danger of God's grace would be as if Paul had been incarcerated. I mean, it's crazy, but Paul is saying to the church, this is not to be seen as a bad thing. This is seen as God's remarkable way, God's generosity reaching out to people who have never expressed any interest in hearing God's promise, who would be the last people to enter any church. And so Paul recognized that he was arrested because he was good. God recognized that he would be the best teacher for this elite group of guards. And so Paul expressed his reasoning for accepting the hardship with gladness and with joy, saying that to live is Christ. So in other words, he will understand his life in terms of the light of Christ. This is that his life is sacrificial in the way that Christ's life was sacrificial. And if the result of this incarceration is death, well, that too is gain. There is no losing in being in Paul's incarceration. So imprisonment, Paul recognized it was his co-participation in Christ's life. And so if he was a co-participant in Christ's life, that his sacrifice too would be out of joy and not out of resentment. And any dying that he would experience in prison, and obviously prison is an experience of constant dying, it would prove to be a gain for the kingdom of for God's kingdom of grace. It would again prove that God's generosity knows no bounds, even if it means binding Paul in prison. Paul, the text, just read this, and Paul seems utterly delighted in his participation. He seems to be delighted in the surprising way that Jesus' strategy in order to spread his gospel. Now, this is a bit whimsical and far-reaching, but I wonder if Paul perhaps even thought that his conversations with the imperial guard might somehow be carried higher. Maybe Paul even thought that it would get to the Emperor Nero, and that God, in his generosity, was trying to find a way to appeal to a corrupt and cruel emperor by putting him in proximity to such an excellent mind and person as Paul. Paul could have resented being an early hire, and that his incarceration would go to somebody as horrible as Nero. But I think Paul is rejoicing that he has gotten into the inner ring that he would not ever that would never have been possible had he not been brought into prison. Paul recognized that he was in fact God's gift to that section of humanity, and that gift of generosity is insane and crazy, and it turns everything on its head, so that even if it involves death, that death is gain.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.